This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm very happy now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Marcy Begleiter. She is a filmmaker, and her new film is a documentary called Eva Hesse. It opens at the CCA this Friday, the 13th of May. She will also be in conversation with critic and author Lucy Lepard on Wednesday, the 18th of May at 7 o'clock at the CCA. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
So I have always loved and admired the work of Eva Hesse, and I've never fully understood why it speaks to me so deeply, and actually more than a lot of the modern art of her contemporaries. And I was very glad that you made this film about her. Tell us how you came to make it.
Well, I discovered the art before I discovered the artist. I was in graduate school in the late 80s, and looking at what was going on in contemporary work. And quite frankly, found a lot of it distanced, ironic, thoughtful. But it didn't speak to me in, I think, the way I was looking for. I found Eva Hesse's work in a book. So I first saw the sculpture just in reproduction. But I was very moved by it, attracted to it. It looked hard and soft. It looked rational and completely absurd and chaotic. It held all of these opposites at the same time. And so that led me to Lucy Lepard. I, was very attracted to the work, and I wanted to know more about the artist behind the work, and that led me to Lucy Lepard's book, Eva Hesse, which was published in 1976. And Lucy, as you know, knew Eva. She was not just an art writer and art critic. There was a personal relationship there in terms of a friendship. Yeah. As well as, these were part, both women were part of a vibrant community of creative people in downtown New York in the 60s. And that's what's in Lucy's book. It's not just Eva, it's sort of that whole art world, who she was hanging out with, what was showing. It's not strictly a biography, but it does quote liberally from Eva's writing. And that would be her journals, or some people call it her diaries, her correspondence, and a long interview that Hesse did with another art critic, Cindy Nemser, in 1970. Anyway, I read the book, read Eva's words, and was really intrigued by this person who was behind this really incredibly moving work. I had mentioned to a friend of mine that I found the writing very interesting, and she was an art librarian and told me that Hesse's archive, all of these unpublished journals and letters, were in a little museum in Oberlin, Ohio.
Oh, my goodness.
The Allen Memorial Art Museum. So, you don't know when those moments happen that kind of change the course of your life. I had an inkling. I had a hunch. I wanted to know more. So I wrote a research grant, and I got some money to go to Oberlin. And I spent about a week, 10 days, in a large, beautiful, large wooden room with light streaming in the windows. And every day they'd give me a pair of white gloves and bring out boxes. And inside the boxes were all of Eva Hesse's papers. And so I got to read them in the original, and they are very interesting as objects as well, and her correspondence. And I read hundreds. There are about 1,200 pages. And, of course, couldn't read all of them in that 1 week there, but read enough so that I was really, I went down the rabbit hole.
Yeah.
I fell down the rabbit hole and came away from that really wanting to engage with the material more. And at that point in my life, I had transitioned from, I went to graduate school in painting and fine art, but I had transitioned into doing writing projects. I was currently working on doing nonfiction pieces as well as writing theatrically. So I started working on a theater piece that ended up being produced in Los Angeles in 2010. It was called Meditations Eva Hesse. And that theater piece, although it had a short run, it was well received, and a producer who had been a friend of mine and someone who had hired me years ago came to see it. And she came to me afterwards and said, I really think this is a good play and I'd like to see it moved. Let's try to do it at a larger venue for a longer run. And at that point, I had not meant Eva's sister. I didn't have any agreement with the estate. So I thought, well, to move on, I really kind of need to approach them. But rather than show up on their doorstep with an already completed play, I decided to do sort of an interim project. I wrote another grant, I got some more research money, and I went out to do 5 interviews with people who had known Eva Hesse very well. And I was going to do a nonfiction piece. And it was in the meeting, sitting across the table from Eva's sister Helen and her husband Tom Doyle, her good friend Gioia Timpanelli, her studio assistant, and of course, and Lucy Lepard, who was actually the first interview. Meeting these people, it just took the project in another direction because they were so engaging. And these were people in their 70s and 80s who had lived extraordinary lives, creative, adventurous, and everyone, every one of them still held Eva very close in their hearts. And that was clear that she hadn't left. So I called Karen and said, I have another idea. And she was on board from day one. She said, if you want to make a documentary, actually, she said, I know what you're going to say. And how do you know what I'm going to say? She said, you're going to tell me you want to make a documentary. I said, how do you know? And she said, in my meditation this morning, I saw you calling me and asking me and telling me that you wanted to do that.
And my goodness.
If you'd like me to produce it, I will.
So that first set of interviews was audio recordings, and then you went back and started actually filming.
Exactly. So the audio recordings led to the sort of the idea, the knowledge that, you know, this was a film that I really wanted to see, and this is a film that Karen Shapiro, my producing partner, wanted to see in the world. And quite frankly, I couldn't believe nobody'd done it. And that was the first
question. I know.
I asked Helen. I called her up. I said, Helen, there must be a doc. I can't find it. Is it out of print? And she said, Marcy, someone came to me a few years ago, but they never came back. And again, sort of not knowing, you know, what would come of it, I said, well, how about if Karen and I try to do that? And she said, go for it. And that was in November of 2011. So it was about 4 years from concept to, you know, it's finished.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Eva Hesse's life. She had a loving family. She also had a rough start in several ways.
Well, yes. I mean, she was born into a Jewish family in Hamburg in 1936. That is not a lucky thing to happen to you.
Right.
So what was very lucky and fortunate is that her father was a very smart and thoughtful guy. He was a lawyer. Of course, he couldn't practice at that point. He had been removed from his profession by the National Socialists in 1933. So Eva was born into a, as you said, a loving family, but it was a complicated situation. They got the children, Eva's mother and father placed the children on one of the last kinder transports to leave Hamburg at the end of 1938. So Eva was not yet 3, and her sister was 5, and their parents didn't know if they would ever see them again. But they did. The parents got out. The rest of the family, unfortunately, perished in the Holocaust. But the parents, Eva's father, mother and father, did get out and came and picked them up. They had been living at a convent in the Netherlands. But the parents came and found them, and eventually they were allowed into this country, in part because there was a cousin who was already well established here and who signed for them. Even her sister ended up growing up in northern Manhattan in an expat German community in Washington Heights. And very early on, even knew she wanted to be an artist. So her education was really top rate. Pratt, which she didn't finish. She decided to go instead to Cooper Union and finally Yale.
It was interesting to me that she went to Germany in the 1960s, and it was so close to World War II that the shadow of the Holocaust and of that whole history was still hanging over everything in a really vivid way. What was that like for her as a person and as an artist, do you think?
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up. It's a very interesting moment in her life. She was married. It was 1964 when she and her husband, Tom Doyle, embarked on a 15-month residency in Kettwig, Germany, which is quite close to Dusseldorf. And the way that came about is that there was a German industrialist in New York going around looking at art. He was an art collector. And he was going around with a German curator, and they came to visit Eva and Tom's loft and saw Tom's work, which they were primarily interested in because he had, at that point, a much more high-profile career than Eva did. But they looked at Eva's work, too. And the invitation was offered that they would come and have everything, their travel expenses, their living expenses, and a stipend would be paid, and they could just do their work. But of course, it could have the invitation, if you think about it, could have come from anywhere. It could have come from London or Paris, but it didn't. It came from Germany. And so this was a very difficult decision for Hesse. You know, on one hand, it's this opportunity to work unencumbered. She, at that point, had, you know, two part-time jobs, as did her husband. Here's this opportunity to really dig into your work. But the flip side of it is, yes, it's in Germany. It's less than 20 years after the end of the war.
Yeah.
But as Eva's sister said, she was really tough and nothing was going to stop her. She was extremely, you know, ambitious. And she was also very introspective in that even at that time, she was writing a lot and sort of exploring her background, her connection to family, her connection to Germany. And this was not something she was going to turn away from. It was not an easy 15 months, but it was in that time with the pressure and the opportunity of seeing an enormous amount of work in Europe that she went from being a painter to a sculptor and started doing the work that we are, you know, that she is best known for.
Yeah. Do you think that there's some sense of Jewish identity in her art?
Not, I mean, the most of the work is non-representational.
Yeah.
So you can't make a direct line from here to there. She's working with forms. She's working with material. She's working with light. She's, you know, working with color in a lot of the work on paper and in the 1965 reliefs. Certainly, her experiences, all of her experiences, fed into what she made and how she saw the world and how she interacted and played with these materials. But do I think I'm not an art historian? My background is more in film and making art. But I, you know, my viewpoint is that as a Jewish woman, as someone who was raised in an observant household, you don't really shed that way of thinking. You don't shed your family of origin. I'm not sure if any of us can.
Yeah.
She was not a practicing Jew in her later life. Then again, her husband did convert. Tom converted in, you know, most part out of respect for Eva's family and her father. But I don't think you can, you know, specifically say, like, this piece, you know, we can see some kind of particularly Jewish influence in this.
Right. We're talking to Marcy Begleiter about her film Eva Hesse. Eva Hesse may not have gotten the attention and respect that she deserved early on, and you talk about this a little bit in the film, because she was a female artist and there was a real bias toward male artists. But by the time she was in her early 30s, she really was a major artist in New York with gallery shows and museum shows and really the highest critical acclaim. How did she achieve that? What brought her into that place of success?
I think really hard work, being really good, and maybe a little bit of luck. But, you know, I think it's mostly the fact that she was extraordinarily intelligent, and she was making important work, and that couldn't be denied. The work was in a place, and of course she put herself in the middle of the New York art scene. From the beginning, when she graduated Yale in 1959, she moved straight to Manhattan. And except for that 15 months in Germany, that's where she stayed, which was really sort of the heart of the art world. So that she was part of that conversation, and not by chance, by design. And yes, there were, she did not have a one-person museum show in her lifetime that I know of. Posthumously, there was a retrospective at the Guggenheim in 1972, but she was certainly being shown in important group shows in institutions, and she had only one-person show of her sculpture in her lifetime at the Fischbach Gallery in November of 1968.
It's interesting because, I mean, thinking about the whole issue of women and women artists, and she didn't like being called a woman artist, she liked being called an artist. Lucy Lepard, who lives here in New Mexico and who you'll be in conversation with next week, is featured in the film quite a bunch of times, and she, as you said, was not only an art writer and curator, but also really developed a friendship with her. And she says in the film, Lucy says, that Eva Hesse's work might be seen as a kind of early feminist art, though it wasn't called that at the time. Mm-hmm. What does that mean to you, what that label feminist art, and how do you see it?
Well, the way Karen and I sometimes talk about it is that Eva was a proto-feminist. If she had lived into the 70s, she might have engaged in that language. But in the 60s, it was important to her to stand alone, to not be ghettoized in any way. She didn't want any labels aside from artists. So at that point, it would have been, you know, it's different than it is today. And she had to work, you know, quite hard to be seen as someone whose work was deserving of the same attention and the same respect as her male colleagues. She was reading Simone de Beauvoir, and she was certainly talking to her friends about how difficult it was as a female to be taken seriously. So proto-feminist, just the feminist word, wasn't really being used as much then. But of course she was in terms of her actions. She was a female, she identified herself as female, as an artist. In the long interview she did with Cindy Nemser in 1970, she certainly didn't, you know, back away from saying all of these things were important in her work and how she comes to making her work and her forms and dealing with materials.
I think there is, I'd love to hear your take on this. I identify very strongly with her work, and I'm not a visual artist, but I mean, as a viewer, there's something in that that speaks to me on a level that's so profound, and I always find myself wondering whether there is some kind of female sensibility that she is just projecting through all this work that she did, because I don't relate to the work of, like, other minimalists and expressionists of her era and around that time in the same way. There's something unique to her, and it's hard to put your finger on that, but do you know what I mean?
I do, because that goes back to me. Honestly, I had that same response, a very similar response, when I first saw the work. It wasn't this, it wasn't that. It had the grid, but it also had these crazy, loopy wires coming out of it. I'm thinking of Metronomic Irregularity, that great piece that she did in Lucy Lepard's show in 1966, Eccentric Abstraction. So it engages your mind, but it also engages your body. And I think that great art functions that way. It's ineffable. You can't really put your finger on exactly why it's moving you. You can try to. You can talk about it and share your experiences. But it has a power to it. And it's still very influential today. I think it looks pretty fresh.
Yeah.
But everyone has, I think, a different response to it. All I can say is your response is shared by a lot of people, that they find themselves very drawn to it. I don't think you can really separate out the fact that she was female with how she is in the world. I mean, that was very much part of who she was. It's, you know, gender is a very important part for all of us, of how we engage in life. So she is someone, having read through all these like 1,200 pages of her writing multiple times, this is someone who is very aware and really, you know, paying attention to who she was in the world, what her thought process was, how people responded to her. She really wanted to sort of get through and to connect in a deep way. And I think because she connected with her work in such a deep way, we feel that when we look at it. Some of us do anyway. I'm sure it's not for everyone.
Yeah, and you can only, and I think that's part of the mystery. I mean, sometimes you can't, no matter how much you analyze it or write about it or read criticism about it, you can't really understand why a work of art is compelling. I mean, somebody puts up a bunch of industrial materials against a wall and you say, this is the most boring thing I've ever seen. And then she stands these sort of like cylinders and pipes on the floor or against the wall, industrial materials. And it's exquisitely beautiful in this way that you don't know why. And somehow I think there's something okay about leaving that mystery for what it is and just like taking in the work.
I think that ends up being what you just said. I think that's exactly it for me as well. The really powerful work, it goes beyond visual art, and we can sort of dance around it with our words, but that doesn't get all the way in.
Toward the end of her life, and it's wonderful that she left so much written material. I mean, she had this handwritten journal, and you show the journal, and you also have somebody speaking her words in a really kind of wonderful way. The film is beautifully done. And she talks toward the end of her life, and she died young. We'll get to that in a moment. But she talks about her art has almost become a kind of non-art. She used that word, non-art. What do you think that means?
Well, that is open to interpretation, isn't it? her writing is quite poetic at times. So I can just give you my interpretation of that, is that the art becoming non-art is, I think, when you make a piece that it doesn't show the making. So that art traditionally would have a certain kind of planning, a certain kind of thoughtfulness in terms of, you know, how, think about other minimalists, not that she was a minimalist, but other work being done around in that time. There was a more deliberate nature to it. And what Hesse did at the end of her life is she really let gravity and the materials take over. The late piece, the rope piece from 1970, or even right after, from 1969, the first piece she did when she got out of the hospital, that there is more of a letting go. And maybe that had something to do with her observation about letting the art be non-art, letting it be non-non, letting it be nothing. So there is a question there about how does it function in the world? Is it art or is it something else?
We're talking to filmmaker Marcy Begleiter about her film Eva Hesse. Eva Hesse died at the age of 34 of a brain tumor, and the last 5 years of her life were very productive. And again, this is a question that's totally open to interpretation, but I found myself wondering as I was watching the documentary, do you think she had some, like, sense of super intensity because she intuited that her life wasn't going to be a full, you know, a long lifetime?
Well, I actually would say that she did have a full life.
I just mean in terms of longevity.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't as long as some lives, but it was longer than others. And she had experienced so much loss in her life and abandonment that, you know, she had a good sense every day that life doesn't last. So when you see that and you have sort of a sense of that, maybe it does push you to do a little more, a little faster. Whether or not she, you know, I have no idea if she had any kind of pre-knowledge. I certainly don't remember reading about, she didn't focus on the fact that life wasn't going to last in her journals. Until really the very, very end of her life, there are a few pages where she starts to deal with the fact that death might be coming soon. But in general, she was very present. And like I said, she was really present, ambitious, hardworking, and she wanted to make it. So she made a lot of stuff. She was a maker.
Yeah. That material that you were just mentioning in her journals, I thought was very moving, the part where she talks about her own sense of mortality and her remarkable peace with that, and even the kind of like enlivening quality of that. And I was thinking back to the fact that we haven't talked about her mother, but her mother was very, I guess, bipolar, and she ended up taking her own life when she found out that her whole family had died in the Holocaust. And so at the age of 10, Eva lost her mother and had, as one might imagine, a kind of melancholy that pervaded her life. And now here she was, having confronted the fact that she had a brain tumor, it was operated on, her headaches went away, and it was like a rebirth for her.
After the first operation, she did feel good, and she renewed that last year of her life. She made a lot of really interesting, ambitious work. And as Bob Mangold says in the film, you know, you could just sit back and focus on your illness.
Right.
But that's not what she did. She, you know, she did what she had to do in terms of trying to get better, but she just kept working at a really disciplined pace.
She also had a sense of the mortality of the work itself, some of which is made with materials that were not archival, that she knew would degrade. How has the work itself actually held up physically?
Well, most of it has held up quite well, actually. The fiberglass pieces, although they have changed color, are quite strong and are, in for the most part, really good shape. The latex pieces, if latex is exposed to light and oxygen, it does break down. And so there's some of that work has begun to age. And as you said, Hesse knew what these materials would do. But at the time that she was making the latex work, she felt that that's the material she needed to attain the forms that she wanted. So she accepted the fact that some of the work was going to age more quickly and more observably than others. And that was okay with her.
What it felt like was that was not only okay with her, but it was part of the thing, that work like all life, kind of comes and goes. It's not necessarily even meant to be here forever.
I think she did have almost an Eastern, at the end of her life, almost an Eastern philosophical approach to that, because she let it go. Yeah. She lived in the present, and then she let it go. And I think my interest in Hesse's life and its relationship to the work, quite frankly, has a lot to do with the way she lived her life at the end. I find it extraordinary and inspiring that someone moves through the end of their life with such openness and feeling that, okay, I did what I needed to do. I'm sure it didn't hurt that in her hospital room at the end, during the last few weeks of her life, her work was on the cover of Art Forum, and they tore the cover off and pasted it, scotch taped it on the wall across from her bed. And her sister says at one point she woke up and pointed at it and said, "That's me."
Yeah.
So she knew that in some way her work had arrived, and I'm sure that felt very good.
Talk about the influence of Eva Hesse's work on other artists, both her contemporaries and in the generations of artists since then.
Well, again, I'm not an art historian, so I wouldn't sort of hazard to point to other artists. Other artists really need to sort of speak for themselves, I think, in terms of saying who their influences are. That said, I think that from what I've heard from people who are, you know, teaching graduate school and art school these days, that Hesse's work is really still a vital influence on young artists, both because of who she was and how and what the work looks like and how she approached making the work. I mean, those unpublished diaries are actually being published this month after decades in that small museum. And the early diaries from when she arrived to New York in 59, kind of through the mid-60s, really shows a portrait of a young woman's challenge of hitting New York in the early 60s and how to maintain some independence as a woman, in addition to have a relationship, in addition to making work, which is going to be part of the art historical conversation, the contemporary art world. And so she was writing about all of these things. And in terms of a legacy for young artists today, the fact that now we've got a documentary out about her, which kind of shows the life and the art and the interaction, as well as the availability of the diaries, will give people a much bigger picture of what was going on at the same time that these great works of art were being made.
You are an artist yourself. You're a filmmaker and also an illustrator and designer. Do you feel like her work has influenced you both in the past and as an artist in the process of making this film?
Well, this film, which I've been working on for the past 4 years, is certainly, whatever it is, it's a film. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a piece of art, but whatever it is out there, it is a combination of all of the various things I've done before. So making art, and sketching for film, being an art director, writing plays. I mean, I've had a winding road to get here.
Yeah.
But I feel like all the things I did before have fed in. Also being a professor at an art college, and teaching film and teaching design, it all fed in to making this project what it is.
Well, I will say as a viewer that the film is a wonderful work of craft and whatever you want to call art or craft, but in the themes that it explores and in the look of the film and the sound of the film and the music. And it was clearly a labor of research, too. I mean, there's a ton of archival material in that. Tell us a little bit more about the process of making the film.
Of course. Well, as you said, there are a lot of archival materials in the film. And I worked part of the time when I was writing the play Meditations Eva Hess, which was produced in 2010. I did some archival research back then, but it was more kind of like background research. But for this film, given the fact that there's very little footage of Eva, we really needed to sort of dig in. And one of the great joys and pleasures of making the film was meeting people who knew Eva, and also asking them to look in their drawers and their closets. And we found a ton of material that the estate didn't even know existed, and that had been sitting for decades in a kind of a dusty corner. So that was extremely exciting.
What kinds of things?
Oh, we found photos and slides and footage. We found footage of her father that her sister had. Again, it was had never been scanned. It was in a box in the back of a closet. And one day when I was leaving her sister's house, I'd been over there shooting some photos of her father's photography, which there's a number of photos that he took in the film. And as I was leaving, I turned around and said, oh, by the way, did you guys ever have a movie camera? And they said, oh, yes, we had a film camera, an 8mm film camera back in the 50s and 60s. We have a box of films. And I said, can I see those, please? And so they handed me this box, went back to my office in L.A., found an old movie viewer. And after looking through them, they were still in the little yellow boxes originally from Kodak.
Yeah.
It sent them in the late 50s and early 60s. And going through it, so there's footage of Eva's father in the film, and that's where it came from. And I could tell you a similar story 10 times over.
Right.
Extraordinary things that came out of, just asking people who knew her. And they went, oh, yeah, I think maybe I've got, something in the closet. and so that archival was really important because it was very important to place this film in the 60s so that you have Eva so modern. She's a very modern-looking girl. And it was important to have photography and footage to give a sense of the streets of the 60s in New York, and also, quite frankly, to have the music. And the whole, we were a German-American co-production. The entire audio track was done in Germany. So we have German composers, Andreas Schaefer and Raphael Siegfried. The sound design and our music supervisor were all German. And we have a grant. We had a grant, a production grant from the German government to cover those costs. So that was very important to us also. We thought that given that this story takes place in Germany and in the States, we were really looking for collaboration on the German side. And the Goethe Institute came in with a very early but a very important research grant for us, Goethe Institute LA, which allowed us to go to Leipzig, to the Leipzig Documentary Festival in 2012 and pitch our film and find our German co-producer. And at that time, we also found Louise Rosen, who is our international TV representative. So that allowed us to do some pre-sales to European television. And this is an independent arts documentary, so raising money for it, we had to be really creative.
How has the film been received in Germany? Does Germany think of her as kind of a German artist or a departed daughter or something like that?
Absolutely. I would say so, yes. The Hamburger Kunsthalle did an Eva Hesse retrospective at the end of 2013. And we shot. They invited us to come And they actually commissioned a short film from us because we had already done quite a bit of shooting, but we edited a 16-minute film for that exhibition, and they built a small screening room on the exhibit floor and ran the film consistently during the exhibit. Eva was born in Hamburg, and this was the 75th anniversary of her having left. So it was a really emotional moment for the family, who was, you know, quite a bit of the family flew in to be there at the opening, and we showed up a few days early, and quite a bit of the footage that you see of her fiberglass pieces, as well as some of the other work, was shot in Germany at that retrospective. But yes, I think that they do seem, she's born in Germany, and of course came back for that all-important 15 months in the mid-60s. And so we have German, French, Dutch, and Swedish pre-sales to television networks. So I think in general, the European entertainment community, broadcast community, was interested in this film before it even was made. They bought it on a pitch and a small sample.
That all-important 15 months when she was in Germany is just so interesting to witness as a viewer, and I encourage everybody who's even remotely interested in art and in the artistic process to go see the film, because one of the things that happens is, I mean, she's a painter, and her paintings are wonderful. I mean, she's a really terrific painter. If she'd spent her whole life being a painter instead of a sculptor, that would have been great too. But there's this process by which she's making two-dimensional art, and then you have these rectangular frames, and things start to come out of them, like as if they were sort of like going from 2D to 3D, like they just want to literally jump out of the frame, and that's where the whole rest of her life's work begins. And it's just so interesting to see that happen, because you see her as really a young woman who is finding her way and has no idea what is to come. And all of this comes as a result of experimentation and play, and even the insecurity behind that is all there. And yet, once it happens, it kind of has a life of its own.
Absolutely. It propelled her into the rest of her life, the rest of her career. And it was really, as you say, it was frustration that partly motivated her. The painting just wasn't going where she needed it to go. She wasn't satisfied. And it was that lack of satisfaction and her just saying, well, I'm just going to try something else. And she was in an abandoned textile factory. And so if you take a look at those reliefs from 1965, and she did 14 of them in a very short amount of time, she started to pick up refuse from the factory floors. And she began to build up the surfaces of her paintings. So those pieces are, you know, they're not exactly paintings. They're not exactly sculptures. There's something in between. And then, of course, that next year she does Hang Up, which is now at the Chicago Art Institute. That extraordinary piece, which is really absurd and references painting and references sculpture and references minimalism. And yet it's just its own crazy thing. And I was delighted that we were able to interview Rosie Goldman, Eva's friend, who donated the sheets that Eva wrapped the frame in, and that Rosie gets to tell that story of watching Eva make that piece, right?
So you interviewed many people in the art world who knew her at that time, the man that she was married to for a while, Tom Doyle. There's footage of the artist Sol LeWitt, who was really like a brother to her and a champion of her work and kept her going emotionally, and a really true friendship and loving relationship. And you also interview her sister, and that was very moving to me as well. Her older sister, very different personality, it seems, probably. What was it like for her and for you witnessing her revisiting her sister's life?
Helen is a wonderful representative of her sister's work and of her sister's legacy. So when Eva died so young, Helen was, you know, the only family member, and so she took this on, and it's really become the center of her life. And she is, we call her the Ever-Ready Bunny. She's in, you know, I'm sure she'd be okay with me saying this, she's in her early 80s, and she goes everywhere. She has enormous humor, and she's got smarts, and she's always up for whatever is coming down the road. She's actually heading to Israel with my producing partner, Karen, next week for the Israeli premiere at Dot Aviv in Tel Aviv, and that's when I'm coming to you in Santa Fe. So Helen was, you know, she's really the one who said, go for it. Without Helen's, you know, encouragement, this doesn't exist. It's her openness and her trust that allowed our research and our project to take shape. And she's been very supportive of it. When she saw it finally, when it was finished, she felt good about it. She felt we had represented her sister fairly and well, and that means a lot.
So, having made this film, what's next for you? Do you have another project on the horizon? Or are you kind of devoting your attention to getting the film out in the world?
Well, right now, I have to still, Karen and I, who, you know, sort of just us in some ways, well, we have a distributor, Zeitgeist Films. The film is being right now scheduled for screenings all over the U.S., and in Germany, it opened 2 weeks ago in over 30 theaters. So the film is kind of finding its way in the world. And right now, we still do need to support it on a daily basis. It's opening in Los Angeles on Friday. It's opening in Santa Fe on Friday. It's, like I said, it's open all over. If anybody wants to go to our website, we keep a pretty up-to-date list of the screenings, and it's evahessadoc.com, like one word, evahessa, D-O-C. So that's really taking now. I certainly have a couple of things on my back burner because this project has been an opportunity to sort of move forward in doing things. This is a very large project, and I would love to be able to do something else. So having come up with sort of the idea to do this and having had it come out into the world, this makes me feel that maybe another one could happen. So yeah, I've got, you know, I'm certainly open to suggestions if people want to come to me, but I have a couple of things that I'm thinking about that are in very kind of early stages of research.
Marcy Buchleiter's documentary is called Eva Hesse, and it opens on the 13th of May, Friday, at the CCA here in Santa Fe. Marcy will be in conversation with art critic Lucy Lepard, who lives in New Mexico, on Wednesday, the 18th of May at 7 o'clock. For more information, you can go to ccasantafe.org and to evahessadoc.com. Marcy, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much as well, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.